I agree that we need seamless coordination between state and federal permitting systems, but this is not how to do it.
Business interests weigh in on the Coastal Management Initiative. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 4th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a young Alaska native carver who gives his art an urban twist.
I like to connect to traditional style, but not necessarily copy it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
The state's largest caribou herd continues to decline. The latest population survey estimates the western Arctic herd at 325,000 animals. State Fish and Game biologist Jim Dow in Kotzebue says the latest number shows continuation of a decline which began in 2003 when the herd numbered 500,000. Dow says given the size and massive range of western Arctic caribou, it's hard to know what's driving the reduction, but he has some ideas, including winter rain.
You know, we had icing events, gosh, going back, you know, as far as records go. But starting around 2005, they became much more serious than we used to see. So I think that caused many, many caribou to die from starvation.
Dow says another likely factor is predation. Meanwhile, the stable harvest of between 14 and 16,000 caribou per year by people represents an increasing percentage of the population. New advisory recommendations from a working group include incremental hunting restrictions and increased monitoring if the caribou population decline persists. Dow says the herd's future is uncertain in light of its history. Back in the early 1970s, he says it went from 242,000 animals down to 75,000.
The amazing thing about that decline was they hit the bottom around 1976 and just immediately started increasing at about 13% a year. So I don't know what changed, but that's remarkable to go from an 18% average annual rate of decline to a 13% increase, and I think it's probably pretty unusual.
Dow says federal surveys have shown a decline in overall coverage of lichen and increases in grasses and shrubs on the caribou's winter range. He says the extent and quality of summer range lichen remains good. The first of 10 public hearings on the proposed Alaska Coastal Zone Management Ballot Initiative took place Monday evening in Soldotna. After expiring in 2011, the state legislature failed to come to an agreement on terms to extend the previous management plan. The initiative will come before voters in August as Proposition 2. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran has more.
Because the public hearings for the Coastal Zone Management Plan are being run as any other legislative hearing, a spokesperson on both sides of the issue was given a few minutes at the beginning of the meeting to promote their case. Public testimony, however, was not as equally balanced.
We as AOGA cannot overemphasize our concern that the impacts of Ballot Measure 2 to development would cause a chilling effect on development and will most certainly send signals that Alaska is not open for business. Government and industry need a clear and concise permitting system.
That was Kara Moriarty, Executive Director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, speaking in opposition to the measure. The points she made about onerous regulation, stifling growth, and inhibiting business opportunities represented a common theme from nearly everyone speaking against the proposal. The initiative, if passed, would create a state division of coastal management and also a coastal policy board consisting of 9 representatives from all parts of the state and commissioners from the Departments of Environmental Conservation, Fish and Game, Natural Resources, and Economic Development. That board would work with NOAA and other federal agencies to craft policies that meet certain objectives, such as development of industrial or commercial enterprises that are consistent with cultural, historic, economic, and environmental interests of the people of the state, among several others. Supporters of the initiative contend that its passage will allow a greater degree of local control over projects on federal lands, a point made here by Representative Paul Seaton of Homer.
The alternative to this is big government. It means big government, whether it's a federal government exercising all the permitting rights on federal lands in the federal OCS, or it means the state permitting agencies exercise the entire permitting authority on projects in the local area.
The corporate interests weren't alone in their opposition. Local small business owners testified against the initiative as well.
I'm not a special interest. I'm not a big corporation. I started my business in 1988 with about 5 employees, and we now have about 75 year-round. And I hope that that's the kind of business and the kind of activity that any good legislation would seek to support. I agree that we need seamless coordination between state and federal permitting systems, but this is not how to do it.
That was John Faulkner, owner of Land's End Resort in Homer and a candidate for the State House in District 30. He went on to say he feels the agencies already in place have both the authority and jurisdiction to effect wise and responsible management of coastal resources. Kenai Borough Assemblymember Linda Murphy served as the voice in support of the initiative to begin the meeting. She says the opposition is well organized and funded.
But I think that there will be a concerted grassroots effort to get the, you know, the word out to the voters. And, you know, Alaskans are very independent-minded. I don't think that they're going to take at face value what they hear from talking heads from the industry. And I also think that they are reading something into the initiative that's not there. It's just a process to coordinate what's happening and to give us some say in what happens in our communities.
Public meetings on the Coastal Management Initiative wrap up in Juneau on July 26th. Voters will have the final say Tuesday, August 28th, during primary voting. From Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
A 2-year-old venture between a native corporation and the community of Cake is making a play in the processing business, but it's also focused on creating jobs. Margaret Friedenauer of member station KHNS reports.
Rocky Pass Seafood out of Cake is operating for a second year. It's a joint venture between the Sea Alaska Native Corporation and Cake Tribal. It operates under an initiative of Ha'ani, Sea Alaska's subsidiary focused on stabilizing economies in Southeast. And that's the primary goal of the venture, said Ha'ani's president and CEO, Russell Dick.
We have to make some bottom line profit for the company. But the idea, again, is about the creation of jobs and local employment opportunities for people who live in our rural communities.
Dick said Ha'ani's goal is to get out to communities and see what existing resources can be built on to create sustainable industries. He said the old cannery and Cake offered just that kind of opportunity. Dick said last year the operation had a few hiccups. The processing plant in Cake hadn't been in operation for about 6 years, and it started late in the season. But it ended up producing about 500,000 pounds of fish and employed about 30 people in Cake, a statistic that Dick said is the real purpose of the venture.
If we have to bring in a significant number of outside workers, then it doesn't make any sense to us.
This year, the operation is employing about 35 people at the plant and on 2 tenders. Because of the energy issues in Cake, the plant is simply heading, gutting, and freezing the fish whole, Dick said.
That's one of the issues that Ha'ani is also wrestling with and will be for quite some time is the energy issue in Southeast Alaska and the fact that Cake, the community of Cake, is on diesel. You know, until that issue gets addressed, it's very difficult for us to do anything else. We can't operate a cold storage in Cake because it's just not profitable for us.
Dixie Hutchinson, spokesperson for Sea Alaska, said Rocky Pass offers fishermen an option that allows more money to stay in the state.
This is such an important part of what Ha'ani does, is that all of the money stays here in Alaska, and it keeps jobs within the communities where we're seeing people leave and having to be separated from their families and cultures.
Rocky Pass is also processing some halibut and is looking into processing black cod. This is Margaret Friedenauer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, young entrepreneurs hit the streets in Unalaska.
I asked my magic 8-ball if we'll get more money from the Living Aid stand, and it said, ask for later.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
Anchorage is sometimes called Alaska's largest native village because it's home to so many Alaska Natives. Drew Michael is one of them, and he's exploring his urban native identity through his art. The mask carver is part of a generation of Alaska Native artists who are blurring the lines between traditional and contemporary art. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Combing hardware stores and junkyards for materials to decorate his masks like wire, plastic, glass, and fiber is something mask carver Drew Michael calls urban subsistence. One of the places he searches for materials is Fred Meyer, near his home in East Anchorage. Today he's searching for something unusual to decorate a mask he's working on.
So here we are. We're in the aisle that I'm looking for, and it's called a wash mitt. Microfiber wash mitt. And it has all these little protrusions that look like little larvas.
Michael brings the glove meant for washing cars back to a spare room in his home, a small ranch-style house in East Anchorage, which doubles as his studio. In the middle of the wood chip-strewn floor is a workbench where he chisels blocks of wood into faces.
So here we go.
The 28-year-old has been carving masks since he was in his early teens. Michael, who is Yupik and Inupiaq, was adopted by a couple teaching school in Bethel, along with his twin brother when he was around a year old. At 13, he took a carving class at the University of Alaska Anchorage to connect with his roots, and he's been carving ever since. In 2008, the Alaska Native Heritage Center purchased one of his masks, and he recently won a Rasmussen Foundation grant to pursue his work. His masks allude to his training with more traditional carvers like Joe Sinungatuk and Kathleen Carlo, but they also reflect his urban environment.
I like to connect to traditional style, but not necessarily copy it. My work, I use different material. I use power tools. I mean, some people even think that's not okay to be doing. I think it's fine. I know how to do things a more traditional way, using just hand tools. But if I can cut out a lot of time and also the wear on my own body, why not?
The masks are sometimes stark and understated, other times startling caricatures. Traditional masks are decorated with feathers or stained with berries. Michael uses his junkyard finds and sometimes spray paint. He says the main stories his masks tell are his own. He points to a piece named Escape that hangs on the wall of his home.
A lot of my early pieces tell a story about feeling trapped, isolated, maybe feeling like I wanted to get out of a situation in my life. Like this piece down here, if you're looking at it, it has hands, these metal hands coming out of the eyes, kind of representing me feeling like I'm trapped within a cage or a prison, trying to get out, like looking out the window.
Michael says he made the mask in 2010 while he was working in the oil fields on the North Slope. He says it was a difficult time. He really wanted to be making art, but he had to earn money to pay off student loans. He quit the oil fields job about a year ago and started carving full-time. In the Alaska Native tradition, masks are destroyed by fire after they're used in a ceremony. Instead of burning his masks up, Michael leaves his carving marks, gently scorching the surface of the wood with a propane torch to add texture and definition.
Got the flame. It's changing the wood color pretty quickly.
Michael says growing up, he didn't want to be Native.
The Native people that I saw when I was growing up were the Natives on the streets. I didn't want to be Native because I didn't want to be associated with that.
But through his art, he realized that he could begin to define what it meant to be an urban Alaska Native.
Soon after that, I got into the carving. And through the carving, I've learned more and more about my identity as an Alaska Native. And I've become more and more proud of it. And now I've even become kind of a leader.
That car cleaning mitt he bought at Fred Meyer, he spray painted it in gold, silver, and bronze. And now he's cutting it apart and attaching it to a cedar mask he's been working on with a staple gun.
So what do we have here?
A mask that has a larger face on the bottom, and then on the left brow, it gets stretched up into another face that's attached to the top of the head on the left side. And on the top is that material that was the glove that we had spray painted.
The name of his new mask? Without Seeing.
I think what's really exciting about what's happening now is Native people are getting a stronger voice. Like they're proud of who they are. The past has a lot of sadness and pain in it, but I think now the culture and the language and the community is actually being celebrated.
He plans to use the $5,000 Rasmussen grant he just received to break ground on a new studio beside his house. That's where he'll soon begin teaching mask carving, and where he hopes to keep the Alaska Native traditions alive with an urban twist. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The Aleut and Aleutic people invented the kayak over 5,000 years ago. Since 90% of their diet came from the ocean, the kayaks were traditionally used for hunting sea life. At the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage, a group of adults are learning the traditional methods of building a kayak, well, almost traditional. APRN's Wendy Jonathan reports.
On the other side of a pond, behind the main theater of the Alaska Native Heritage Center, three men and a young intern are circling the skeletons of two 21-foot-long kayaks. One of the men, Peter Totemhoff, is there to learn how to build kayaks to reconnect with his culture. He says the word is traditionally spelled with Q's, not K's.
Kayak. It's kayak.
The team is sticking to traditional building methods, but with a little help from some modern materials. Kayaks were traditionally covered with seal skin, but today the crew is using a synthetic man-made covering. Totemhoff believes the authentic materials were more well-suited for the Alaska environment.
The real thing was living. It stretched and dried and with the weather.
The group is also getting a little help from Lowe's, Home Depot, and electricity, which was not available during traditional times. Andrew Obayo, a cultural ambassador at the Heritage Center, says they are about a week and a half into the project and about halfway finished building the two kayaks.
With today's materials, modern conveniences, we can build the kayaks in 3 weeks. Of course, in traditional times, it took up to 1 year to build one kayak. It was just one man building his kayak because he had to collect all the driftwood, he had to hunt for the animals, he had to work and prepare the skin for the kayaks.
Though modern conveniences are accelerating the building process, Abayo says that the general construction plan is traditional.
All the joints are lashed, we have no nails, no staples, so it's made to be flexible.
Abayo says it's important that the kayaks be comfortable and easy to maneuver because the kayak was such a vital part of the hunter's life.
For a hunter to be in a kayak up to 15 to 20 hours was nothing to them. Can you imagine paddling for 1 hour? They paddled for 15 to 20 hours without stopping.
There is no definite schedule yet, but Abayu plans to continue to teach kayak building skills at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. But he says he hasn't always been this in touch with his heritage.
Up until 2004, I just did a 9-to-5 job. And at the time, I had my two daughters. And they didn't know their culture. So I couldn't blame nobody else if they didn't know their culture if I didn't try myself.
Abayo says it took one class at the Alaska Native Center in 2004 to reinforce his cultural foundations and to make him proud to be an Alaskan Native. Now he teaches multiple classes because he values learning and wants to continue to pass down traditions. In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Jonathan.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Think safety when out boating or doing activities near water. When boating, always wear a personal flotation device. Bring some kind of communication with you and do not overload the boat. Let family or friends know where you're going and when you plan to return. Find out more at alaskaboatingsafety.org and pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium's Injury Prevention Program.
Big city newspapers are struggling to compete with the internet these days, but one Alaska woman is using the changing times to reinvigorate a small town publication. Vanta Schaefer moved from Tennessee to Alaska 2 decades ago and now runs a bookstore in Seward. Schaefer says she started the Seward Journal a year or so ago because she felt there was a lack of coverage of community events.
The story is right now that newspapers are dying and everything is going online. But then I started researching small community newspapers, and they were doing really well because, you know, people led their community paper. So I decided to take the plunge and try it. I mean, you know, if you never take a risk, you never know what might happen. So I'm kind of a risk taker, and I did.
How did you learn the newspaper business?
Well, I am an English major, so part of that helps. I'm not a journalism major, you know. I've read newspapers since I was old enough to read, and, you know, I don't know what to do without my daily newspaper. I feel really bereft if I don't have it. So I talked to Colleen Kelly, who had been a reporter for and editor of the Seward Phoenix Log here for many years. She told me what kind of program to get, what kind of design program to get to put on the computer to lay the paper out. Because when I opened up that program, I'm going, oh, my gosh, this is Greek. I'm never going to learn it. And she came up here and, you know, showed me how to do several things. So the paper has really improved from, like, its very first paper.
You're saying that a lot of what you learned came from people who were already in Seward that were already friends of yours. Did you hire in new people?
Yeah, actually, I had a lot of young people come in. People were, you know, they're in their late 20s, early 30s. And, you know, they said, hey, Vanta, we want to write for the paper. And I said, okay, that'd be great. And then they told me what they wanted to cover. You know, this isn't a full-time job for anyone but me. And I have a bookstore also. So, you know, it's kind of patching together something to make something work here in Seward. It's really been a community effort.
In your view, why do you think small local papers succeed when large city papers are just plummeting?
I personally think parents like to be able to buy a paper that has their child's picture in it and cut that picture out and put it in a scrapbook for their child. You know, it's those kind of things big papers don't do hardly anymore. And, you know, I have a little thing I put in the paper I call What's the Good News? And a lot of people have told me that's their most favorite thing to read because they like hearing what's good in town. And one of the nicest compliments I received since starting this paper was when a young mother looked at me and she said, you know, I really like Seward a lot better after reading your paper. Because people don't always realize that there's a lot of good stuff that goes on here.
Vanta Schaefer is owner and editor of the Seward Journal. With many kids spending as much of their summer days online as outside, there's something a little quaint about the lemonade stand that just popped up in Unalaska. But as KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, the operation can't be described as old-fashioned.
As cars approach the intersection of Broadway and Seward in Unalaska, a small boy waits for customers. Wearing a fall jacket to guard against the chilly weather, he sits behind an overturned box decorated with a colorful sign. On the ground next to him, a pitcher of ice-cold lemonade. I drop in the day after the lemonade stand's grand opening. It's cold and cloudy, so business is slow. But when it was sunny the day before, they made $48. Talking to the boys, I notice something a little strange about the way brothers Jordan and Jacob and their friends, Fook and Vladimir, run the stand. It comes through when they bicker over how many cups of lemonade they're allowed to drink on the job.
Until we close, you get one at the starting, one in the middle, and one at the end.
Or when Jacob, age 5, tells me what he likes best about guarding the cash box.
Because I can have my break whenever I want.
Though their product is simple, the boys are all business. Still, they get excited over a sale, just like you'd expect of any kid. Fook waves their sign in the air as a customer approaches.
They're coming!
The man hands the boys a crisp $5 bill.
There you go. Keep the change.
You don't even need any?
No. Go ahead and put it towards your program or whatever you're doing. Thank you, guys. Have a good day.
This man raises a good point. Just what program is this lemonade stand funding? 9-year-old Jordan, who's the boss here, answers that question.
Me and my brother, Vladimir and my friend Fook, we're all going to split the money, and me and my brother are going to be trying to save up money to get an Android tablet.
An Android tablet?
Because it's just like an iPad, and it's smaller and cheaper.
How much cheaper is it than an iPad?
iPads are like $500 and Android tablets are $89.99.
Jordan and Jacob want the Android for games and music, Justin Bieber mostly. Though they'd get to $89.99 faster if they didn't have to share their profit with their friends, the brothers realized that more help equals more money overall. Fook and Vladimir take turns scouting for cars on a bike. They herd them up the block to the stand, where Jacob guards their cash register, a lunchbox that has Lightning McQueen of the Pixar movie Cars plastered on it. The boys want to see that box fill up. Fresh squeezed lemonade just isn't profitable in a town where lemons are $2 apiece. To keep costs low, they're sticking to Country Time lemonade powder and water and selling each cup for 75 cents. Jordan and Jacob's mom is their angel investor. She paid for their cups and their first two canisters of lemonade mix, and she gave them a $10 loan so they could make change.
My mom says she better get an iPad or an Android tablet before me, but she's probably not going to get it before me.
Their mom, Jessica Tivoli, stops at the stand on her way to the supermarket to check on the boys. We chat for a while about the lesson she hoped the kids would learn in business, namely that if they want something, they have to earn the money to pay for it themselves. Before she leaves, Jordan stops his mom and asks her to buy him gummies at the store. She agrees.
But it comes out of your money, so out of what you make, I take what it
what?
Costs.
What? No.
Well?
Out of everyone's.
No. If you want gummies, you pay for gummies.
Fine, get me a gummies.
Okay.
I'm just... No, wait! Actually, don't you dare, because we have some at home.
Jordan runs up the hill to his parents' house. Jacob and Vladimir set more cups of lemonade out at the stand and wait for Jordan to return. He comes back, clutching a Pop-Tart. While he was up there, he tells me he tried to get a long-range business forecast.
I asked my magic 8-ball if we'll get more money from the lemonade stand, and it said, ask later.
Hey, get some lemonade!
If the stand does well this summer, Jordan says he might open it again next year. But like most businesses operating in this economy, the lemonade stand would probably downsize. Jordan says he would only rehire himself, his brother Jacob, and his best employee, Vladimir. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Daisha Ayton in Anchorage, and Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska. APRN's Wendy Jonathan reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Wall. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Happy 4th of July.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Meridian Management, specializing in coordination and management of all phases of construction projects from vision to completion, working to ensure that your project is on time and on budget. More at meridianak.com. The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. Avtech is recruiting rural Alaskans for computer and network training with no cost tuition for qualified applicants. For more about the Village Internet Agent Program, call 1-800-478-5389. This message sponsored by Avtech, Alaska's Institute of Technology.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.